Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. This week, we're wrapping up our conversation with Dr. Donald Wunsch on his experiences with AI and his recent article in the IEEE Computational Intelligence magazine about artificial general intelligence. This is the sixth part of our conversation with Dr. Wunsch, so if you've not listened to the earlier portions, I'd encourage you to do so. Now, here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
The last thing I want to talk about is regulation of government. One of the things that you mentioned previously was that you favored national regulation of AI. I certainly don't agree with that. I think that states need the right to do this. Now, the problem, of course, is regulatory compliance. And my son runs a business, an accounting business that goes across many states. And he says keeping up with the regulatory stuff is just incredibly terrible. But we do have a lot of things coming out. We have, for example, Grok, who can synthesize pornographic conversations. We have OpenAI, which says it's going to start to do adult content. And, you know, in Texas, you have to have age verification before adult sites. And also, the other example is marijuana. You know, some states say it's okay. Some states say that it's not okay. So I recently went to Denver, Colorado, and there was this big sign up. It says cannabis. And you could go in there and buy everything from tobacco, marijuana, tobacco, to probably gummy bears. And that's totally illegal in the state of Texas. And I like that. I like that autonomy at the local level. The price is, of course, the overregulation of things and the degree to which compliance must be adhered to. So could you elaborate on what you think that things should be just done on the federal level?
Yeah. So for one thing, there was a law that got passed the legislature in the state of California, but was vetoed by Gavin Newsom. And I think that he made the right decision to veto this law because it included sanctions, punishment, including possible jail time for developers of AI. These were things that were actually more the responsibility of the companies that employed these developers. And so there were some pretty big problems with that proposed legislation. So the federal government has a role of regulating interstate commerce. I do think that there's an appropriate role for states in certain regulations, but they have to be bounded so that companies know what to work with, what to deal with. There are certainly very different attitudes in different states regarding something like pornography, regarding the protection of children. There are no really easy answers to these issues. I think that at least certain types of regulations need to be uniform nationwide.
Of course.
Yeah, and so, but it's a very nuanced conversation. and so I do think the IEEE has an important role to play, particularly the intersection between energy and
okay,
AI.
Let's talk about IEEE then.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't think, I served on a committee. One of the other members that you know is Paul Werbos, that was on that committee that produced a report right around a year ago about energy and AI and the demands that AI is making on the energy grid. And it emphasized, I was lobbying for it to not lobbying. It's not lobbying. We're a non-lobbying organization, but the IEEE has its lobbyists, but this was a committee that talks to the IEEE, and then the IEEE goes and makes its policy recommendations informed by the committee. With the blessing of my management at the university, I joined this committee and encouraged the other committee members, and they agreed to insert into the report language about the importance of having the power generation and transmission capability that these bigger AI systems are inexorably going to demand. Because if you don't do that, you hamstring the companies. And so that's one thing that is, there's so many nuances to AI policy. And so there's the infrastructure, the costs. I think it's quite appropriate, and this is something that can be done at the state level, but also there are important conversations about doing it at the federal level. If you plunk down a bunch of big data centers and they use a lot of energy, they should be paying for that increased consumption of energy. That should not be
not the consumer.
Yeah, that's good, that should not be floated among the consumers. And so, and this has happened, and it's there are conversations about correcting that. And I think that we're sensitized as society to that now, to a larger degree than we were even 2 or 3 years ago. And so there are conversations happening at the federal and local levels. I spoke with some of our utility people, you know, in Phelps County, Missouri, where my university is, and they're very attuned to that. So if somebody wants to open up a big data center, they're going to be expected to pay for that new resource coming online. But to what degree that's just good management and the people that run the utilities understand that and are sensitive to that and starting to respond to that versus what to what degree these are codified into law, these are things that pretty quickly need to get sorted out. And so movement is going in that direction, and the IEEE is helping with these conversations.
So I have a thought here. At the end of World War II, if you ask technology where it should go, I think at least electrical engineering, they would say, well, we need better vacuum tubes. We need better filaments with greater reliability. We need better vacuums in there. And nobody recognizing the fact that, that semiconductors were just on the horizon. I'm wondering... And this is just wondering if sometime that they're going to figure out a new way, people, research scientists, research engineers are going to find out a new way to train without the consumption of all this energy. There was speculation when DeepSeek in China came out that they had found a new way to do that. I think that that's pretty well been debunked now. They haven't found a new way to do the training. But this is forecasting the future, and I think would be really, really great if we could train these transformers with a lot less power. I wonder if that's ever going to happen.
Well, we have an existence proof between our ears, and so if I haven't mentioned it before, I think I've mentioned it in my paper, yes, that we use about 20 watts, and in the bad old days before LED light bulbs became common, 20 watts was a dim bulb. And so dim bulb is no longer an insult, but a compliment. What we can do with our dim bulb worth of energy is not a dim bulb capability at all. It's brilliant and a gift from God. And so I do think that we, you know, we have a gift of nuclear energy that we can use. Yeah. If we don't use it for good, it's probably inexorable to be used for evil. So we need to use nuclear energy for good, and I think that's very important. But I think that it is at least as important, to learn from what we see in biology. And so I gave the examples of insects before. So my pet peeve is when articles talk about the human brain and modeling the human brain. We can do a lot by learning from a bug's brain. But a goal that is too lofty in the near term, but should always be like a star, like a guiding star, is the fact of the remarkable level of computation that can be done with 20 watts. And so if we can do more biologically inspired computing, the reason that we do these massive vector matrix multiplications is they work, and engineers understand them. And so These things that happen in biology, the capabilities are amazing, but they're also messy. It's harder to write theorems about them. It's harder to guarantee what their behavior will be. And so the progress is of necessity going to be slower, and it's also so multidisciplinary. So you can get an electrical engineer together and talk to a mathematician, and you can get really far because the fields are pretty close together. But if you start pulling together these things that are, you know, are relevant, but where the languages are different and where there's so much that needs to be learned and so far that one has to come, it's just more challenging. It takes more time. And this is another example of the importance of what humans bring to the table. And can AI help? Probably yes. So can you summarize something from Eric Kandel's Principles of Neuroscience, which is a book about the equivalent of this whole stack of books, and summarize points that an electrical engineer might need to know? Maybe an AI could help you with that a lot, but there are still points of connections that human beings currently can make better. And so that's why I'd say to somebody, one, to policymakers, is to encourage these multidisciplinary directions. To students, I'd say, be curious and learn a lot of different things. You'd be surprised at what you might get out of a history class or a philosophy class, things that you never dreamed would be related to AI, but very much are. And so those are a couple of things that that can emerge from these type of discussions.
Well, you know, all of the advances of AI have been from the human intellect, from Hebb's law to Bernie Woodrow's Adeline to Paul Werbos's error back propagation to GANs and diffusion models and to transformers. These have all been the product of the human brain. AI is never going to create a better AI. And I think it's going to be interesting. The thing I like to forecast is that the future is not forecastable. So you would like to hope that some of these things would happen in the future and that we wouldn't need all of this consumption of power. And your point about the human brain is well taken.
Bug brains,
even bug brains, yeah. So let's return to government regulation. And the thing is that I think that federal regulation of AI is going to favor big AI. And we have big AI, the people like Grok and OpenAI. It's going to favor them and it's going to make it more difficult for the smaller entrepreneur actually to develop their businesses.
Yeah, that's one thing that it's been, I think, about 2 years now, or almost 2 years, and somebody put onto some discussion group, watch Altman, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, never say the government needs to regulate AI. And within an hour, he posted the government needs to regulate AI. And more recently, the administration declared that there would be a $100,000 fee for H-1B visas, for new H-1B visas. And I wrote one of my senators and said that if this is a warning shot to industry to cut it off with all these massive layoffs, of computer scientists. In other words, if you're laying them off, then you don't need to import them and we're going to put some pressure on you, then it might be a brilliant move, but as a threat, as a bluff. But if it's the real policy that's going to be here from now on, it's a mistake. That's just my opinion, but that's my opinion. We became a great country by attracting people from all over the world, and we want them to come legally, but we need them there. That's important. But we certainly need to put pressure on the companies to say, hey, these big AI companies, to have layoffs of tens of thousands of computer scientists, not a good move and not good for the country. And if you're benefiting from certain federal policies, maybe we should shoot some warning shots across your bow to say that we may have to look at what you're doing. Well, I misjudged that situation entirely. Again, Sam Altman came out very quickly after that and said, well, I think that's a good idea. I went, ah, of course he thinks it's a good idea. Okay. It raises his moat, you know, so that means that the fledgling startups that might destroy his whole business model with the, with something that uses 10,000 times less power to train their system will be less likely to blindside him. So he loves the idea. He can afford the lawyers. 100,000 is chump change to him. And so the lawyers to help with the regulatory things, paying fees to the government, all these are just barriers to entry of the competitors. And so it's exactly the point that you're raising that, and I've thought about this stuff. I have an MBA. I engage, I read these things. I put the news stories on my website. I completely missed it. Just and as soon as I saw his response, I went, of course he's responding that way. So that's one of the things that unintended consequences of well-meaning regulation can just be explosive. And also it can be hard to undo. So anyway, we need to tread very carefully. There are real threats from AI, like to privacy. These need to be dealt with fairly aggressively. But when it comes to doing something where the big organizations just lawyer up and hire a bunch of people to deal with the regulations, that
small companies can't do that.
Right. Yeah. And the line of demarcation might not be just big organizations and small organizations. So there might be something that makes, remember, we're in an international, very international field. So something that that may make a big university less competitive. And even a medium-sized university looks like a big organization when these regulators are talking about, say, number of employees or the overall budget of the organization. So something that might that you might think only hits a Google or a Meta or an Amazon could wind up hitting a Baylor or a Missouri S&T. So you have to be really careful about these regulations, but there are some things that just have to be dealt with. The risk to privacy is an enormous one.
I think one of the big forcing functions now on the development of AI is possibly flawed. China, for example, is explicitly committed to AI dominance. We hear the White House talking about AI dominance. And as you mentioned, a lot of these politicians can't even spell AI if you spot them the A. I thought that was a very, very, very insightful thing. But I think the assumption there is that we're going to generate super intelligence and that AI is going to become more, more creative than the human being and is going to take over. And I don't think it's ever going to be more creative than the human being. And I also believe that we're experiencing a diminishing return. If you look at the ChatGPT 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, I mean, 4 to 5, people hardly noticed a big difference. So it seems to be that there's diminishing returns as we reach an asymptote. And it's going to take another technological breakthrough, such as the Transformer paper, in order to do that. And so I guess my question is, do you think that the government is generating all of this interest and attention to artificial intelligence based on this flawed idea that we're going to eventually generate superintelligence?
In some ways, superintelligence has already been generated, but it is not what people mean when they talk about artificial general intelligence or superintelligence. So there's been recent news.
So it's a matter of definition, you're saying.
Exactly. So Jan LeCun and Demis Hassabis, who both of whom I respect tremendously, I admire the work of both of these men. In the last couple of weeks, they've had some public postings arguing with each other. LeCun has been saying artificial general intelligence is nonsense, which is basically what I've said in my article, and I cited LeCun when I said that. And Hassabis, since he was a new PhD, has had a vision for artificial general intelligence of DeepMind, which was taken over by Google. And what I would say is that the ability to generalize from what you have been trained on, what your system, I don't want to over anthropomorphize it. So the ability of an AI system to generalize from what it's been explicitly trained on to something to which that training could be useful if it adapted to the new challenge. If you define it in such a manner, then you could say, yes, things like that can happen. And so their earliest successes were in an arena where everything's games, and you train on one set of games, and then it self-learns other games. And the thing that got him the Nobel Prize that I think was very well deserved, he did it with a big team of people.
Say, who is this again?
Demis Hassabis, the CEO of DeepMind.
The thing that
his team did. So the thing that really skyrocketed them at first was when they beat the Korean Go champion.
And by the way, Don, I remember you working on the game of Go, right?
I thought it would take a century, but I never dreamed that Google would invest half a billion dollars to take over DeepMind and then give them about another $500 million worth of resources to solve the problem. And I think earlier we talked about that their market cap that went up by several billion after they accomplished it. But what Hassabis did that I thought was pure genius, I thought it was pure genius just to do what they did and already make that milestone of AlphaGo. And I believe I already recommended the movie AlphaGo. But what I think was another genius step was to say, this could be mapped to the protein folding problem.
Yeah.
But that was mapped with a lot of human input. And it was a human light bulb that went off that said, let's make that mapping. Let's solve that problem. I will not be surprised to see AI systems be developed that do things that continue to surprise us and think that these are things that used to only be capabilities of humans, and then something gets done. So to have a system do things that its designer did not expect it to do, to have a system do things that go beyond what was in its training set, even the ability of a system to generate things that appear quite novel. I've been very impressed with some of these capabilities. They're most impressive when they're done in conjunction with human input. So I might have already told you this, but there's a wonderful song from before I was born, I think, called "These Foolish Things Remind Me of You."
I've never heard of that.
Oh, you got to listen to the song, "These Foolish Things Remind Me of You." But I prompted either Gemini or ChatGPT to come up with something to the same meter that are "These Stupid Things Remind Me of You." So "These Foolish Things Remind Me of You," they're a cute little series of romantic things that remind somebody of their former girlfriend and very romantic song. But "These Stupid Things Remind Me of You" are little things that annoy you about the partner. And I had it make a few verses for a female and a few verses for a male. And it needed my prompting to get it right. But in the end, it was quite funny. And I could not have done that by myself, but its first attempt was pretty good. But after a couple of tweaks, it was really good. And so I would not be surprised to see some future system that could do them where they're really good off of the get-go. I would not be surprised to see future systems that compose pretty novel, say, words and lyrics to music that people like, that are that get further afield from things that were directly inspired by other humans, but they will still not replace human musicians. Humans will think of things that the AI never came up with. The AI may create things, but still, this is something where you can stack the deck in favor of the computer. To tell a computer, okay, go get wood and metal and strings if you want them, or glass or water, or, you know, blowing through metal structures, go get whatever you want and make a new instrument and then play something interesting with that new instrument. That would be a lot harder for an AI to do, and humans have been doing that for millennia, you know. So that's the embodied AI challenge. But even if you go beyond the embodied AI challenge, I think that's just a subset of the challenges that are out there. But back to your question, you're talking about things that may blindside everybody, things that may develop in the field of AI that nobody thought of. And we talked about biologically inspired AI and developing AI that doesn't have anywhere near the power requirements that we thought of. Another thing that people are thinking about that can really change the game a lot is quantum. And so if you can take things that are NP hard, non-deterministic polynomial hard, things that where the combinatoric explosion is just enormous and you have to sort through a lot of things and it takes humans or computers a long time to solve these problems. And if you could solve them very quickly, beyond anything that anybody ever imagined, that would have implications for AI, things that even humans and animals have difficulty doing. If those could be done more quickly, that might create surprising capabilities. So, like optimization of a set of complex decisions. And if you can have a computer do that better, that's very valuable. So like one thing that you might have seen the news stories, Warren Buffett retired at the end of 2025. So as of January 21st, he's the chairman of the board, but no longer the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. One thing that he said was that his skills have been very rewarded, but they're very narrow, and that his secretary would survive in a jungle much easier than he would. but that the skills of capital allocation are valued greatly by society, and he gets rewarded because he's good at capital allocation. You could imagine that maybe a computer could be developed. I don't think that'll be better than all humans at capital allocation. I think humans will still see things that computers miss, but it might be the case that computers get developed that are better than, say, 95% of the human experts at capital allocation, and these people get compensated very well for that expertise. So a computer that is able to say, let me rebalance your portfolio for you, and it'll do better than these people that you're paying 3% of your portfolio to do that. Actually, probably a little smaller than that, but still too much, right? And so for a mere fraction of what these humans are charging you, this AI will do something that is better than most of these humans. That could be very disruptive.
Well, Don, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the idea of quantum. Quantum has been around for years. I think I first heard, Feynman was the guy that proposed the idea of quantum computing, but research into quantum computing has been going on for 30 years. And I'm hearing a lot of people just bailing from quantum computing research because it isn't going to work. If we did get quantum computer working, do you think that AI training would be a lot easier? And I haven't followed very much quantum computing and AI. So
yes, I think quantum computing, if there were a breakthrough in quantum computing, it would get us a long way towards this 20 watt goal. So the idea of you know, I talked about biologically inspired approaches, but if you just wanted to say, let's use the Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation of reinforcement learning, which is just a way of the simple way of explaining it is it's a way of mapping the target that you would get. Like if you're doing supervised learning, you have an input come into your neural net, and here's your black box neural net, here comes your input. It gives you an output, and at first it's garbage, but here you give it another output that is good, and then it does gradient descent on the weights of this black box and until it gets you a better output, and it keeps on trying to do that, and it gets pretty good. And that makes it sound simple, but actually it's a challenging problem. But the field has come a long way in dealing with that challenging problem. And what has been happening in the field of reinforcement learning for a matter of decades has been to say, well, if you're instead of having a desired target, you have this output and you have an oracle that tells you what's the right answer, you don't really need all that. What you need is a cost function. You need something to say, okay, you're doing better or you're doing worse, and this is your reinforcement signal. And so basically the reinforcement signal gives you the gradient that you want, the derivative with respect to these weights that you want. Because let's say it's a reward like you're making money or a punishment like you're losing money. Well, if you're making money, you just say, I want it to make more. And if you're losing money, you say, I want it to lose less. And so you know the direction to adapt these weights. That's what you really need, the direction. And then the rest is design, right? How fast do you want it to learn? If it learns too fast, it's not stable. If it learns too slow, it costs too much. But that's the basic heart of it, okay? Well, what if you can solve the optimization problem of all those weight updates 1,000 times faster?
Yeah, that would be
that's
be nice.
Worth a lot, right? That's yeah, worth a lot. And so it might involve no insight other than what we currently have, but if you can solve that optimization problem a lot faster, that's worth, that would be a tremendous breakthrough for certain subsets of AI. And these subsets of AI are extremely important subsets. Right. If you can do reinforcement learning faster, that might not help you much with unsupervised learning, but who cares? You know, you're going to solve a lot of applications with that. And so something that could run on your watch as opposed to something that fills a building with computers, that could be really interesting. Right.
That would be really nice. Well, if we could get it to work, but we've tried for a long time, and maybe right. There'll be a breakthrough. Maybe it's like string theory. Maybe it'll never happen.
Well, and we worked in optical computing, and
we did.
And so I remember your joke about it was that some people say it'll be in 30 years. Some people say it'll be infinity, and perhaps it'll be the arithmetic mean. So my dissertation was in 1991, and so now it's been 35 years, and so the field of optical computing has got some interesting things. You know, silicon photonics was not much of a thing in 1991, and so there's still interesting progress. You know, the progress is far from zero. And so I'm not pessimistic about optical computing. I'm not pessimistic about quantum computing, because you have grandchildren. I have a child. Hope to someday have grandchildren, and then great grandchildren, and so on. It's like both Moses and Martin Luther King said, "I've been to the mountaintop." Right. So you go to the mountaintop, you see, Newton said, if I've seen star, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. Well, I think I've sat in the laps of the giants like a puppy dog, and I've still seen further because I'm sitting in the laps of the giants. And so,
Great metaphor.
That's I really do think that it's been very rewarding just to be like a puppy dog in this environment, because there's just so much. Living in this time around the people who've developed this field would be like living in physics with a lifespan of half a millennium. There's just so much that's happened in what, like the 38 years since I met you, or the 40 years that I've worked in the field. The amount of things that have happened have been tremendously. I've met a lot of these people because of you. And I've interviewed a lot of them for the IEEE Computational Intelligence Society History Committee, or the International Neural Network Society History Committee. There have been so many people that have just made massive impact on the field. And so it doesn't take a genius to see things that were unimaginable a few years ago. And so I predict that a few years from now, we're going to have multiple surprises and multiple breakthroughs that right now people would be very skeptical about and just say, I don't believe that's going to happen. But even then, there's still going to be enormous vistas that have not even scratched the surface. And so, like, I would not be surprised if insect intelligence is still not achieved by 2030. Okay, I wouldn't be surprised if we actually do have it for, let's say, one example insect. but the portfolio of the various insect intelligence, no, I predict we will not have replicated the portfolio of, let's say, 100 different capabilities of insects in a compelling way. I'm not talking about simulation. I'm talking about actual ability of 100 different insects to do things in the real world. I don't think that we will have that level of capability. And I do think that the developments in AI will be the limiting factor. There are limiting factors of physical robots as well, but I think we will not have solved all the computation problems, all the machine learning problems, all the AI in the situated world problems to replicate the capability of, say, the 100 most interesting insects or the mouse brain. If somebody says, I'm modeling the human brain, in any of these interviews, if somebody says, I'm modeling the human brain, or we're working on replicating the capabilities of the human brain, ask them, well, can you do a mouse brain? And if they say, oh, we could, but we're not that interested, how about a bug brain? How about a fly's brain? How about a fruit fly's brain? If a house fly is too hard for you, how about a fruit fly's brain? Can you do that? And so far the answers are no. And I think they're going to remain no for a little while. We may get to house fly brain or a fruit fly brain or praying mantis brain. But I don't think we'll have 100 examples like that by 2030. It's already 2026. So some people smarter than me have predicted we're going to have human intelligence, AI like humans, by 2030. Okay, Demis Hassabis, he was a chess champion as a small child. Okay.
Yeah, but he's also the head of a big company. I don't think he's disinterested in this commentary.
Right, but the thing is, I'm saying I'll give him that, okay? Even before he got his Nobel Prize, I would have said, all right, that guy's smarter than me. I can't do a lot of things that he's done, but he's wrong if he says that we're going to have human-level AGI by 2030. What we will have is AIs that can do a lot of things that we didn't think that they could do, that we thought was the pure purview of humans. But we also will not have artificial praying mantis, artificial bumblebee, artificial house fly, artificial fruit fly. If you can't do 100 of those,
You can't do that.
You can't do the human level thing. So
I tell you, Don, I just bought a Tesla.
Oh, great, great.
A self-driving Tesla. Now, it's supposed to be supervised, but I'm going to get a software update that makes it totally, totally driverless. I tell you, man, it's amazing. It is incredible. If anybody hasn't driven in a Tesla, go to a dealer and have a test drive in it. It'll blow your mind. You'll want one. They are just astonishing.
Yeah, I do want one. I'm.
Yeah,
they're good cars. But I please do stay alert and keep your hands on the wheel. I don't trust.
No, you don't. You don't need it anymore. So far, it's been just incredible. So I'm really amazed. It will go into a parking lot, find you a parking place, back into it perfectly. You can stand 100 feet away and go summons. The car drives itself to you. My window got dirty and it turned out the windshield wipers automatically. It's just
watch out for the corner cases. So look at my keynote from November in Rio de Janeiro. The slides are on the AI News website. I posted them there. And the first or second slide, one of the early slides, there's several things about the chat. The chat bots, encouraging kids to commit suicide and encouraging another guy to do the murder-suicide. But there's on the lower right-hand side, there's some like the number of deadly accidents with self-driving cars. And so,
but you know what Elon Musk says about that?
Yeah.
He says it's a lot less than if humans were driving the car.
Right.
And yeah, self-driving cars are going to have accidents. So the question from a meta argument is what is the percentage of accidents? And is it more or less? Yeah, Teslas are going to have accidents.
Right. And so one of the things, Missy Cunningham, you can look up her. She's one of the critics of Tesla. She was in the federal government around the same time that I was, and she's a very noted researcher. I think she's at George Mason University now. And she has some interesting postings about it. And one of her arguments is that it should be able to pass a driver's license test, not the written test, the driving test, and some other things. There's some...
My Tesla would pass the driver's test, I think. Okay. And I think they've improved it a lot. Look, Don, we've been going for a long time, and we got to wrap it up. So let me ask you a final question, okay? You wrote the paper, and we've talked about it, is artificial general intelligence is nowhere near. Artificial specific stupidity is already here. Policy implications. If listeners remember only one takeaway from your paper, what would it be? Summarize it. Be Grok or ChatGPT and summarize the takeaway in just a few sentences.
I need a moment to think about that.
Okay.
I guess ChatGPT would think about it for a moment too. So.
Yes, it would. It would. Yeah, and it's terrible in generating images. You mentioned that the word human should be a red flag. I don't know what you meant by that.
Okay, yeah. So there are three things that I'd like to mention. I'll lead with that. It's just my pet peeve, but I think I'll lead with that. My pet peeve is when AI researchers, or as more often happens when like a journalist writes about an AI researcher and the AI researcher doesn't correct them, and claims of modeling human brain or modeling human intelligence and so on, my knee-jerk reaction is blow the whistle and call bunk. The degree to which we understand human capabilities is still quite limited. And so in my slide deck, not in the paper, but in my slide deck, I pull some stuff from a book by Douglas Hofstadter from about a decade ago. And he's very famous for the book Gödel, Escher, and Bach. An
Eternal great book. Great book.
That book is incredible, magnificent. But he has a more recent book about a decade ago called Surfaces and Essences. And even reading one chapter of that book will convince you that we're nowhere close. The way that we can make connections between disparate concepts through analogical reasoning is just mind-boggling. And that book is basically a mountain of counterexamples. So basically, if people say that they're on the track by anything in this century about replicating human brain capabilities. It's just nonsense. And so related to that is the claim that wasn't my idea. But this was my inference from Hofstra wasn't trying to make that case, but he was making the case that we do analogical reasoning and there's this rich tapestry of that. And what I'd say is a corollary to this giant tome that he wrote about that is that we're a long way from it and have no credible prospects of getting those kind of capabilities anytime soon. So Surfaces and Essences by Douglas Hofstetter, and he's got a French co-author on there. That's a remarkable book, and it won't take long to convince you that, yeah, our systems are nowhere close to being doing that. So
does he state this specifically?
It's implied. It's a wonderful book. So I don't say that in the paper, but I do say that I've got this pet peeve about claims of human intelligence, and the kind of a more focused thing about that pet peeve is the argument that general intelligence does not exist. Therefore, artificial general intelligence is not going to exist either. We've developed intelligence that is well suited for our needs, but a different intelligence exists in the form of dog intelligence. So I think earlier I mentioned to you that a dog is like a walking nose. They devote so much of their brain to the sense of smell. So intelligence is not general. It's specific, and it should be that way. And it's that way for very good reasons. And so artificial general intelligence is nowhere near. It's not coming. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So my immense admiration for Demis Hassabis is because I probably owe him a personal debt of gratitude and will probably live longer because of these accomplishments in protein folding. And I think that there will continue to be amazing accomplishments. And I think he and DeepMind will be among the leaders in these amazing accomplishments. And so will Lacoon, and so will OpenAI, and so will Meta, even without Lacoon, and so will Amazon. There will be a number of major contributions. So will xAI, which is the company that Musk has with Grok. There will be all these amazing accomplishments from these companies and from these universities that will move the field forward, for which we need to be very grateful. Most, if not all, of these will be focused on really valuable problems. And some of them will be valuable problems that you and I will have said, they're not going to get there in the next 10 years, and then they will, and they'll surprise us. But that's not the same thing as a human intelligence. So a lot of surprise, first of all, that a lot of these claims are not coming. Second, a lot of things that will surprise even the people who say these claims are not coming, those surprises are coming. And then the other thing, that I would like to emphasize is that they're coming in ways that none of us will predict. So we need to be very careful about policy, and we need to understand that there are risks and rewards of AI, and we should be focused on mitigating the risks and maximizing the rewards. And so we need to have a lot of personal wisdom and a lot of policy wisdom. And it's going to take all of us to get there. It's going to take a lot of different stakeholders, a lot of different disciplines, a lot of different sources of wisdom, a lot of different stories about people's lived experiences with AI. And so that could come from like how it affects children, how it affects people who don't have access to the compute resources that others do. It will take all of us to really have a good answer to what should happen with AI, what could happen with AI, what we can help to have happen with AI. And that's part of what makes the field so exciting. I'm like a kid in the candy store because I like all these different disciplines. I haven't encountered a subject yet. I've encountered subjects that I thought would be boring, and then when I learned about them, and I found out they weren't boring. And so it really is a remarkable time to be working in this field, because there is no other field other than, so I've used the term AI a lot. It's the same thing as neural nets. Basically, neural nets have taken over most of AI. And there are pieces of AI that are not neural nets that deserve to rise up again too. But basically, working in this field has been like carte blanche to work on anything, because it's touched everything. Yes. So it's like, I'm about to turn 65 next month. I'm too old to have been diagnosed with ADHD when I was a kid. They basically didn't say, you've got ADHD. They just said, oh, you're this wild little guy running around doing what you feel like.
Don, well, like me, you're a nerd.
So. Yeah, so it's a great time to be a nerd. It's a great time to be curious. It's a great time to be interested in everything. It's no longer a weakness, it's a strength to be exploring all sorts of different things and to be curious about a lot of things. And sometimes you need to take a deep dive in something and become an expert in something narrow. That's important too. It's just such an exciting time to be working in AI, because that touches everything. So you can work on anything you feel like if you're working in AI. And so that's one thing. One thing we're doing at my university is AI plus X, where X is all of our degrees. And so, so that's really a great thing to do. AI can impact whatever profession a person's in. AI has the potential to impact it, and you can learn things that will amplify your profession and perhaps also give feedback to the field of AI. So it's just such an exciting time to be working in the field, and we need to encourage that.
Well, I've heard it said there's two types of engineers. There's people with problems looking for solutions, such as power engineering and microwave engineering, and then there's people with solutions looking for problems. I think that artificial intelligence is in the latter category, and there's lots of problems that we can help solve. So thank you, Don.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, if you want to dig deeper into some of the things that Don has talked about, please visit his blog. We're putting that in the podcast notes. His paper, Artificial General Intelligence, is nowhere near. Artificial Specific Stupidity is already here. Policy Implications, you can probably enter that in Google Scholar. Yes. And get yourself a hit. And we've also provided a link for there. Now, Donald, who we've been talking to for a long time, is a Mary Kay Findlay Missouri Distinguished Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He's at Missouri University for Science and Technology. He's the director of the Kummer Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. He's award-winning. He's worked at the NSF. Some of his awards include the Gabor and Lovelace Award from INNS, which is the International Neural Network Society. And he won a Pioneer Award from IEEE, the IEEE Computational Intelligence Society. So, Don, thank you for this time. I think it was a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much, Bob. And I learned a lot of that from you. So I appreciate
okay, well, thank you.
You've been a wonderful advisor and colleague and friend all these years, so I'm grateful.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. Until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.